learn your future. The words were encircled by symbols associated with soothsayers and oracles through the ages, a pentalpha created with five interlaced A's, an ankh, a quarter moon encircled by seven stars, the palm of a hand with a single eye gazing out from it. I hadn't needed psychic magnetism to lead me to this place. I'd half convinced myself that I would discover the cultists in the carnival, but my truest reason for coming there, more unconscious than not, had been to learn if the fortune-telling machine, Gypsy Mummy, still dispensed predictions. As on that well-remembered night 6 years earlier, a sawdust floor had been spread wall to wall. It lent a woodsy smell to the arcade. 33 machines of prophecy were arranged in rows, some quaint contraptions dating to the 1940s, others of recent invention. You could use two controls to operate a mechanical claw, the hand of fate, to fish among a collection of small, painted, numbered wooden balls in a glass case. Once the claw seized a number, you could press the corresponding digit on a keyboard, whereupon your fortune would be dispensed to you on a printed card. You could seek your future on a video screen, where for 50 cents you would be dealt seven virtual playing cards face down, from which you were to select three, then seven more from which you were to select two, then seven more from which you were to select another two. When all the cards you chose were then revealed, the machine printed under each its meaning, and combined the seven in a single prognostication. Or you could instead choose any of 31 other contraptions that would, with machine-like indifference, tell you if you would have a long life or a short one, a happy marriage or one of wedded misery. 15 or 20 people were sampling the various oracles, moving on to another if they didn't like what the first had prophesied. In the center of the tent, on an elevated platform, a cashier sat within a small circular desk, changing dollar bills into quarters when she wasn't reading a Nora Roberts romance novel. Even before I went looking for it, I was certain that I would find what I sought, and so I got change for $2. At the back of the tent, where it had been on that long-ago night, Gypsy Mummy stood as if she'd been waiting 6 years just for me. 19. Roughly the shape of an old-fashioned phone booth, the machine stood 7 feet high. The lower 3 feet were enclosed, and the upper four featured glass on three sides. In that display case sat a female dwarf, in a costume of the kind gypsies wore only in old movies starring Lon Chaney or Bela Lugosi or Boris Karloff. Black ballet slippers, black silk pants, a red and gold scarf for a belt, a red and black scarf tied around the head. She evidently liked jewelry, two necklaces, a pendant, several rings with large stones, and big dangling earrings. Gnarled and withered, her bejeweled hands rested palms down on her thighs, her fingernails were green, perhaps not with polish but with mold. Her skin appeared to be as crisp as paper, wrinkled, and yet stretched so tight across the skull that it seemed as though at any moment it might split open from the stress. Her eyelids and her lips were sewn shut with black thread. According to a plaque, here before me sat the mummified corpse of a gypsy dwarf, a renowned fortune-teller in 18th-century Europe, so accurate in her predictions that she'd been summoned before royalty in three kingdoms to consult with monarchs. In truth, the figure had most likely been sculpted by a low-rent artist who worked best when inebriated. Regardless of its origins, whether mummified flesh and bones or clay and wire and latex, there might be some magic in Gypsy Mummy. The source of magic in this world is more mysterious than all the explanations that sorcerers and wizards have given for it, and it's more prevalent than can be understood by those who live according to the constricted form of reason so prevalent in our time. On the night that Stormy and I had come here, when we were but 16 and expected to grow old together. A man and woman in their early 20s were already consulting Gypsy Mummy. They appeared to be mystified by the predictions that they'd received, though the meaning seemed clear to us. Each time they fed a quarter to the machine, the woman asked aloud, "Gypsy Mummy, tell us, will Johnny and I have a long and happy marriage?" Johnny read the cards as he received them. The first declared, "A cold wind blows, and each night seems to last 1,000 years. Thereafter, the machine produced, "The fool leaps from the cliff, but the winter lake below is frozen," followed by the even more ominous, "The orchard of blighted trees produces poisonous fruit." They were not pleased with Gypsy Mummy, but by the 8th card they were more annoyed with each other than with the mummified sage, bickering over their interpretations, which in every case failed to grasp the most obvious meaning. With our first coin, Stormy and I received, "You are destined to be together forever." We didn't spend a second quarter. There was nothing else we needed to know. In the 6 years since my previous petition to Gypsy Mummy, the machine had been modified to require 2 quarters per fortune. When offering their divinations, even deceased gypsies needed to account for inflation. "How long do I have to wait," I murmured, "before your promise to me comes true?" For 50 cents, I received a card that offered no prediction on either side. I suppose that in any stack of pre-printed fortunes put into the machine, there might be a blank or two. Another 50 cents got me a second card with not a word on it. Wondering if I'd been expected, if someone might be watching me right that minute, I looked around, but the other patrons were preoccupied with their claptrap profits. The cashier had her nose in the romance novel. I studied the stitched eyelids beyond the glass. Stormy used to insist that after we received the cards so desired by Johnny and his girlfriend, the mummified dwarf had opened one eye and winked. It made no sense that sewn shut eyes could wink, especially when the coarse black thread wasn't broken. Whether the wink might have been a moment of magic, or whether it was nothing more than a little fantasy that Stormy wanted to believe, I never questioned her claim, because it gave her such pleasure to think it had happened. Again, I asked, "How long do I have to wait before your promise to me comes true?" I paid 2 more quarters, listened to them clink in the machine's cash box, and received a 3rd blank card. After a 4th of the same, I pretended interest in some of the nearby soothsaying contraptions and waited for someone else to feed coins to the gypsy. Maybe 10 minutes passed before 2 girls, about 14 years old, approached the machine. Each spent 50 cents, for which she got a printed card that she shared with her friend. They conferred over the meaning of their fortunes, giggled, and then swapped cards, each apparently preferring the other's future. They wandered away, sharing the popcorn. Neither girl had spoken aloud to the gypsy, as instructions above the coin feed directed, and I'd had no opportunity to see the messages on their cards, which they took away with them. Clearly, however, they had not received blanks. You might say that it was just a machine, that the cards were stacked in the mechanism in no particular order, that getting 4 blanks for $2 was nothing more than happenstance. All of that is rational, and certainly in the case of the 2 girls and others who consulted Gypsy Mummy, your point would be irrefutable. But in my life, uncanny things had happened to me with some regularity, not just related to my ability to see lingering spirits and to find my way by psychic magnetism. Because of my other experiences, I could not be shaken from the belief that the 4 cards without fortunes would have come to me if I'd consulted Gypsy Mummy hours earlier or hours later. Besides, for 6 years, I had believed in the message on the card in my wallet, and for most of the past 2 years, that promise, and sometimes it alone, had sustained me. I could no more stop believing in Gypsy Mummy than I could stop believing in my own existence. Leaving the arcade, I was able to imagine two meanings that the blank cards might have been intended to convey. First, that the promise to me would not be kept. Second, that I had so little time to live that I didn't have any future on which the mummified oracle could comment. I much preferred interpretation number two. Just outside of the tent, watching the people who busied along the concourse, I had a sense of time running out. I checked my watch. 7:40. The crowd would keep growing for another couple of hours. Because of the jackpot drawing, the carnival wouldn't close until well after midnight. Perhaps not until 1 in the morning. If there was something important for me to learn here, I still had plenty of time to discover it. I concentrated on the name Wolfgang and tried to hear his whiskey-soaked voice in my mind's ear. Had I seen his face when he and his companions had pursued me through the dark mall, psychic magnetism would now be more likely to draw me to him. But because his voice had been so distinctive, perhaps it would serve nearly as well. Turning right, I joined the crowd and headed along a length of the midway that I had not yet explored. I had taken no more than a dozen steps when I turned abruptly, colliding with a woman in a green fishnet top and red culottes. I apologized, though considering her outfit, she should have apologized as well, and I set off back the way I'd come. Past the Dodgem cars, where drivers crashed into one another with glee. Past the High Striker, where a muscular customer swung the sledgehammer and rang the bell. Toward the flatbed truck with the two huge swiveling spotlights. Toward the major sideshows that occupied the east end of the southern concourse. Psychic magnetism had never before worked so quickly, had never drawn me with such power and urgency as this. 20. I was compelled to move, move, move. The compulsion grew so strong that I almost broke into a run, but to avoid drawing attention to myself, I exercised restraint as best I could. On rare occasions, when this curious talent of mine grew especially powerful, I was to a degree at its mercy, crashing forward almost recklessly, afraid that I might plunge into some peril that I would not recognize until too late. 100 people had gathered in front of adjacent sideshows where 2 barkers ballyhooed their attractions. I slipped through the crowd and between the 2 large tents, heading off the midway, hoping that no carnies or security guards would notice me. Shadows closed in quicker than I expected. I slowed down a little, fearing of tripping over something and impaling myself on one of the steel tent stakes, or garroting myself on a guy rope. Such a death was exactly the kind of end I might decisively, if unconsciously, bring upon myself, to prove once and for all that I didn't deserve the unwanted label hero, that I was only a fry cook, and a clumsy one. Behind the tents, the elevated midway withered down to a service road. I sprinted across the blacktop and checked my pace again as I found myself on another slope, this one darker and much longer than the first, covered in wild grass as high as my knees. The hullabaloo and razzle-dazzle of the midway faded significantly. The most immediate sound became the chorus of crickets all around me. The night was warm enough that I worried about rattlesnakes, which in the right conditions like to hunt in the dark for just such prey as crickets and grass toads. Below lay a large graveled area that, during fair week, became a campground for the carnies, with water and electrical hookups. At least 200 travel trailers and motorhomes were parked in rows. Some were owned by concessionaires who operated independently within the carnival, on-the-road homes for them and their families. Others belonged to Sombra Brothers and were rented to those carnies who didn't have their own accommodations. From about the age of 12 until Stormy and I became an item, every fair week I'd hung out in the carnival. I'd gotten some part-time work at a grab joint, flipping hamburgers and manning the deep fryer, which is where I first discovered my inner fry cook. I'd met a lot of carnies, and I'd liked most of them. In the mainstream culture, they lived as outsiders, and so did I to some extent, though by necessity rather than by choice. Now, As I was drawn into the graveled lanes between the rows of trailers and motorhomes, most of the windows were dark, because every able-bodied member of the community had gone to work. In those places where amber lamplight warmed a pane of glass, most likely an aging grandparent or a young mother with an infant looked forward to the return of the others and to the little private family time between the post-midnight shutdown of the midway and the show call, which was usually noon on Monday through Thursday, 11 a.m. on Friday and Saturday. I came to a large motorhome with light in many of its windows. A curtain had been drawn across the windshield for privacy, and blinds covered the panes in both front doors. I felt compelled to open the door on the passenger side, and I took hold of the handle. But then I thought I heard muffled voices. I stifled the urge to go inside, at least by that route. After circling the big vehicle, I found a back entrance on the port flank, and no light glowed in the small pane centered in the upper portion of it. I tried the door. It wasn't locked. Sometimes I thought that my paranormal gift must have come with a measure of madness, though not insanity so fervid that I needed to be locked up for the protection of the community. My derangement put at jeopardy no one but myself. Ozzie Boone said that any talent, whether to write songs or to write novels or to track people by psychic magnetism, came with the obligation to use it to the fullest of one's ability, with a fierce commitment barely distinguishable from neurotic obsession. A writer, he believed, had to stretch with every book, to explore kinds of stories that he'd never told before, to employ narrative techniques that tested the limits of his gift. In fact, he said commitment to the point of obsession wasn't merely an obligation, but a necessity. The sine qua non, without which the novelist might as well bite on a shotgun barrel and exit this life as Hemingway had done. Ozzie had a tendency toward rhetorical flamboyance that I found charming and amusing. By his own admission, however, he had not lived up to his ideal, and I wondered if a high-fat, 6,000-calorie diet was for him a slow-motion shotgun. As for my psychic magnetism, according to Ozzie's philosophy, considering that it was a talent, I had no choice but to take it to the max. No acceptable moral choice other than to jump out of an airplane without a parachute if that's what it told me to do. Now, it demanded that I open the back door of the motorhome, which I did, and the door didn't creak, for which I was grateful, and I stepped up and inside into a mostly dark room, and the vehicle was so large and so stable that it didn't rock in the slightest when it took on my weight. Barely enough pale light fell through an open interior door to reveal that I had entered a bedroom. I stood listening, and after a moment I heard low voices. Two men, forward in the vehicle. I couldn't understand what they were saying. Hoping to hear them more clearly, I moved to the open door and stood beside it, my left ear past the jamb. The distance was still too great, their voices too muted, for me to hear more than one word in 10, and none of those seemed to belong in the same conversation. Daring to lean past the jam to scout the territory, I saw on the right an open sliding door, and beyond it a bathroom. Past the bath lay a kitchen area that was open to a dining nook forward of it. On the left, opposite the bath, was the entrance to what might have been a second bedroom. From my angle, I couldn't see what lay forward of there, on the left, but I imagined a fairly spacious lounge. Ordinarily, I wouldn't have been so bold as to go farther than the back room of the motorhome, but this was no ordinary night. Hour by hour, my sense of impending catastrophe became more urgent, and images from the dream flood kept rising unbidden in my mind. Other nightmares usually faded from recollection more rapidly with every minute that passed after I woke, but this one had tenure in my memory, growing more detailed each time that a moment from it rose in my mind's eye, as if the vividness of the nightmare increased as we drew nearer to the event that it predicted. I drew the Glock from the shoulder holster under the powder blue sport jacket, and stepped out of the darkness, into the short hallway between the second bedroom and the bath. Just as I crossed the threshold, two men appeared toward the front of the motorhome, coming from the area that I supposed must be a lounge. I froze, but when neither of them looked toward me, I sidestepped through the open door of the bathroom. Now that their positions in relation to mine had changed, I could better hear them as they moved toward the passenger door and then stopped to settle an ongoing discussion. "I still don't get why."
"Why? You don't get why?"
"Because he must have seen all three of them, that's why."
"Yeah, so?"
"Burn Eccles thinks the guy knows things."
"What things?"
Burn Eccles, a former Pico Mundo cop, had also been a member of a satanic cult, and with others, he had planned the shooting at the Green Moon Mall, plus a bombing that never happened. He was serving a life sentence in prison.
"Eccles doesn't know what things."
"Cripes, Jim. Kind of extreme, don't you think?"
"What is?" Jim asked.
"This. This, what we did here. Just because this idiot Eccles doesn't know what."
"No, see, Eccles has tried to figure out what happened back then, when their attack on the mall went wrong."
"But you said he doesn't know what happened."
"He's got a theory. It only makes sense to him if the guy who took them down has some real mojo."
"What mojo?"
Jim said. "Eccles thinks all kinds of mojo."
"Maybe Eccles has shit for brains."
"No, Bob, he's a smart guy.
So smart he's behind bars for life."
"Because the freak has mojo."
"What freak?" Bob asked.
"Eccles calls him a freak."
Although I look as ordinary as the next guy, I suspected the freak under discussion was me.
Bob said, "We're the ones with mojo."
"Contumax."
"Potestas."
"Heil Hitler," I murmured from my listening post just inside the bathroom.
"We've got the dark mojo," Jim said. "Maybe the freak has the other kind."
"Well, I don't like hearing that."
"I don't like saying it. But he sure had something in Nevada, didn't he? And who's dead out there in the desert? Our guys are the freak. Eccles is right. Some kind of mojo."
"Eccles have anything specific or just more blather?"
Jim said, "For one thing, maybe once this freak has met you or touched you or even just seen you, he has a way of tracking you no matter where you are."
"Tracking? Like he's a damn Tonto or something?"
"Tracking by mojo."
"Yeah, so?"
Jim said, "If he tracked Wolfgang's crew, they might lead him to us."
"Why not send them away? Let him track them out to Florida or wherever the hell."
"He'd probably know they were misleading him."
"Probably? All this because probably?"
"He'd stay here in Pico Mundo," Jim insisted. "Once he saw them, they should have killed him. They tried, but they couldn't. Anyway, there's no time to play games with him. It's happening."
With a note of wonder in his voice, Bob said,
"It really is, isn't it?" "It sure is. It's happening."
They were silent for a moment, and then Bob said,
"What kind of world is it going to be after it happens?"
Jim didn't need to mull over his answer. He said at once,
"Ours. It's going to be our world, brother."
"Contumax."
"Potestas."
"Lunatics," I murmured. Footsteps. A door opened. It closed. Silence. When I felt certain that I was alone, I stepped out of the bathroom, pistol in hand, and moved forward through the motorhome. In the lounge were two dead men and one dead woman. 21. When I was no longer of the world, I would miss its extravagant beauty. I would miss the complex and charming layers of subterfuge by which the truth of the world's mysteries were withheld from us, even as we were tantalized and enchanted by them. I would miss the kindness of good people who were compassionate when so many were pitiless, who made their way through so much corruption without being corrupted themselves, who eschewed envy in a world of envy, who eschewed greed in a world of greed, who valued truth and could not be drowned in a sea of lies. For they shone, and, by the light they cast, They'd warmed me all my life. I would not miss the indifference in the face of suffering, the hatred, the violence, the cruelty, the lust for power that so many people brought to the pageant of humanity. In the lounge, or living room, of the motorhome, the two men and the woman had been made to kneel side by side in front of a sofa. Each had been shot, execution style, in the back of the head, and slumped face down into the hideous discharge from their exit wounds. The murders must have occurred before I entered the vehicle, perhaps only moments before, and the guns must have been fitted with sound suppressors. Three victims, two killers, and yet there were no signs of a struggle. I couldn't help but wonder if the dead, who were clearly compatriots of the two gunmen, had not understood what would be done to them. Supposing instead that they knew their fates as soon as Jim and Bob arrived, then could it be that strict obedience to the cult required them to acquiesce without resistance? The latter possibility chilled me. If they were so brainwashed as to be unable to defend their lives, if they were so profoundly committed to evil that they would sacrifice themselves upon its altar, stopping their plan for the destruction of Pico Mundo might be even more difficult than I already anticipated it would. They were, of course, the three who had pursued me in the abandoned mall barely 16 hours earlier. Wolfgang, Jonathan, and Celine. I'd not glimpsed their faces then, and I was grateful that their ruined countenances were pressed into the sofa cushions, sparing me the sight of them now. None of their spirits had lingered, which was no surprise. I've noticed over the years that some good people linger, as do some not so good as they ought to be. But really bad people split the scene when their heart thumps out the last beat. I suspect perhaps they owe a serious debt, and the creditor wants to collect it without delay. I holstered the Glock, and with some disgust, I fished the wallet out of one of the men's jeans. From a credit card pocket in the wallet, I withdrew a California driver's license. His name, or at least the name under which he obtained the license, was Wolfgang Leopold Schmidt. His photo ID revealed one of those rare Neanderthals who believed that a close shave, an expensive haircut, a crisp white shirt, and a sincere smile could help him pass for human. He was wrong about that. I dropped the wallet on the floor and took my tinkered-with, highly secure, untraceable smartphone from a jacket pocket. When I switched it on, the bright gold exclamation point appeared against a black background. Edie Fisher, the elderly lady who had founded whatever secret organization employed Deacon Maybell Bullock, wore a brooch in the shape of an exclamation point formed from gold, diamonds, and rubies. In her company, when people asked her what the exclamation point meant, she had said at one time or another that it meant seize the day, or live life to the fullest, or sister, what a hoot it is to be me. Later, when she had pinned the brooch to the sleeve of a sweater that I wore under a bulletproof vest, just before I went into action against the cult in Nevada, she admitted that it meant none of those things. When I asked what it did mean, she'd said, "Never you mind what it means." Then she had sent me off to rescue 17 kidnapped children. She promised the brooch would bring me through the night alive, and whether the jewelry had anything to do with it or not, I did survive. I entered my access code in the phone. After my smiling face replaced the exclamation point, the phone didn't look as smart as it was supposed to be. But I was then able to make a call. When Chief Wyatt Porter answered his cell on the third ring, I said, "Sir, I'm sorry if I'm about to ruin a lovely evening with Mrs. Porter."
"It wouldn't be the first time, Adi. Just good to have you back in town."
"Sir, I know your department does some disaster planning. What I'm wondering is, if Malo Suerte Dam collapsed, do you know if maybe enough water would pour out of the lake so that Pico Mundo might be completely submerged?"
"Why would the dam collapse?"
"If maybe somebody blew it up."
"Who wants to blow it up?"
"I'm not sure anyone does." I found myself staring at the three dead people, and I turned my back to them. "But if someone does want to do it, then they're members of a satanic cult."
"This again. I was hoping you were wrong about that when you mentioned it at breakfast.
I wish I had been.
The bastard shot me the last time.
I remember, sir.
What do people get from all that devil mumbo-jumbo anyway?
A sense of purpose, I guess.
They could volunteer at an animal shelter instead.
Yes, sir, but then they wouldn't get to have group sex while wearing goat horns or kill people for fun.
I never gave a whole lot of thought to the dam being blown up. I'd have to talk to some knowledgeable people about whether it would put us underwater. What I know for sure is it wouldn't do us any good.
Maybe you could send some people out there to the dam to have a look at it.
I'll be there myself at first light.
I mean, now, sir.
It's almost 8 o'clock. Can't inspect all that much in the dark, son.
Well, you could look around and see if maybe there's a truck full of explosives parked on the dam.
I thought this was a what-if chat.
It's more of a what-if-right-now chat.
Seems like you must have been back more than just a day. What with all this you've already stirred up?
I hit the ground running, sir.
Well, all right, then. I'll get on out there to Malo Suerte and see what's what.
You'll probably have to send deputies, sir. There's another thing you'll want to deal with yourself.
We only have one dam. What else do these ignorant fools want to blow up?
They've killed 3 of their own. Blew their brains out. He sighed.
I should have retired after I was shot.
You're still a young man, sir. I gave him the make and model of the motorhome and described its approximate position in the Kearney campground.
Why kill their own?
He asked. From what I can gather, they thought I had a lead on these 3 and that through them maybe I'd find the others.
Evidently you did have a lead on them. I'll be there with a crime scene team. We'll talk.
Well, I won't be here, sir. I've got this other thing I really have to do.
What thing?
I won't know until I go after it and find it. You remember how this works when I'm on the hunt?
It's all coming back to me. You aren't getting in over your head, are you, Adi?
If I am, I won't know it till I'm there.
Carla's making you her famous apple dumplings.
I love those dumplings.
After she's gone to all that work, son, you better stay alive so you can eat them.
Count on it, I said. But I didn't tell him about the 4 blank cards from Gypsy Mummy. I terminated the call and switched off the phone and, without looking back at the 3 dead bodies, I left the motorhome by the front passenger door. The night remained warm enough for rattlesnakes, but I was less concerned about literal serpents than I was about the figurative ones like Jim and Bob. It wouldn't make much sense for them to hang around the immediate area, waiting to be linked to the murders that they'd committed. On the other hand, you couldn't expect normal behavior from guys who hoped that if they committed enough mayhem in this world, they would earn for themselves a lucrative franchise selling dung sandwiches in hell. Moving along a darkish lane between rows of travel trailers and motorhomes, acutely aware of the weight of the Glock in my shoulder holster, I kept my right hand flat against my chest, as if I was suffering a bout of acid reflux, the better to execute a quick draw if necessary. 22. I was nearly out of the encampment, intending to return to the midway, when from between a pair of large RVs stepped 2 men. In the gloom, I almost drew down on them before I realized they were not Jim and Bob. As they approached, and we met in the fall of light from one of the few lampposts in the campground, one of the men proved to be a tall, muscular specimen, wearing nothing but tennis shoes without socks, a pair of shorts, and a tapestry of tattoos that covered his bald head, face, and entire body. The other, a dwarf, wore a furry costume and carried the realistic-looking head of a baby bear under his right arm. The little person said, "Hey, dude." I said, "Hey." They stopped in front of me, and for some reason I stopped too, although I should have kept moving. The moment felt surreal, but at the same time there was about it a quality of hyper-reality. Even as I regarded those 2 men, I became aware of the flying beams of the spotlights to the northeast, painting ephemeral infinity symbols across the pregnant clouds that increasingly commanded the sky. Of the distant roller coaster chain clacking through the ratchet angles of the guideway as cars full of riders climbed an incline toward the next long drop. Of the dusty smell of the campground, and of the scent of rain pending. The many musics from the carnival volplane to us, distorted by distance, tantalizing the part of us that seeks sensation as an antidote for dread, while at the same time triggering a vague alarm. I thought this would have been akin to the music that had played throughout Prince Prospero's castle in Poe's The Mask of the Red Death, during the final horrific hours when the thousand revelers, certain that the plague could be denied entrance by the abbey's battlements, discovered the Angel of Death in costume among them, when blood then issued from their every pore. I was aware of the faint thrum of wings, as unseen night birds or bats traveled the darkness overhead, of snowflake moths that swooped in seeming ecstasy around the light atop the lamppost, of exaggerated moth shadows sliding, quivering down the walls of a nearby motorhome and rippling across the graveled ground. The rush of detail conveyed by my inexplicably heightened senses served to emphasize the surreal pair before me, so that they seemed to have stepped through a tear in reality from some place beyond. This is a moment. Stay with it, I told myself, though at the time I could not have explained what a moment meant. The illustrated man said, "Cool face." I'd all but forgotten my harlequin disguise. Connie did it.
You know Connie?
Only because she painted my face.
Yeah, the little person said, but that's her real name.
Suspicion scrunched up in the big guy's colorful, ink-festooned countenance.
What are you?
Excuse me?
Are you a carny? I don't get a carny vibe from you.
No, sir, I'm just a guy.
Connie wouldn't give a real name to a mark, he said,
by which he meant a patron of the carnival, someone not part of their tightly knit clan. I reminded Connie of her brother, Ethan. That revelation astonished both men, and the little person said to his companion,
"What do you think, Ollie?"
Ollie didn't know.
"What do you think, Lou?"
"She talked family with him, like he was one of us."
They returned their attention to me. After a silence, I said, "I need to get going." Ollie scowled again.
"Wait, wait, wait."
His small friend said,
"I want to shake your hand, dude. But not in this bear suit, and it takes a while for me to skin out of this damn thing."
"I'll shake your paw," I said, holding out my hand.
"No, that won't work," Lou said.
"That won't do any good at all,"
Ollie agreed.
"Put your hand on my head," Lou said.
"Why?"
"I won't bite it, I swear. Ever since that little person in that reality TV show, people think we've all got an edge. I don't have an edge."
"He doesn't,"
the tattooed strongman agreed.
"He's every bit as gentle as he looks."
"What's your name, dude?"
"Norman," I lied.
"Listen, Norman, I wouldn't hurt a rattlesnake if it was wrapped around my leg."
Ollie said,
"He wouldn't even hurt his own mother, and that mean bitch sure as hell deserved it."
Lou shrugged his furry shoulders as if to say that your mom was your mom regardless of what atrocities she'd committed, a philosophical position with which I had some sympathy.
"Norman, listen. Please just put your hand on my head so I can see something. It won't take but a few seconds."
When I hesitated, Ollie said,
"Pretend you're checking him to see if he has a fever."
I wanted to be out of there before Chief Porter and his CSI team showed up. However, I was intrigued by Lou's request, and intuition kept assuring me that this was a moment. Besides, in spite of Ollie's size, these two weren't the least threatening. They might have been a vaudeville act that had been transported through time from Broadway circa 1920 to this lamp-lit graveled stage, where they only wanted to amuse. I pretended to be checking Lou for a fever, maybe related to the ursine flu, when the palm of my hand met his forehead. I felt a weird tingle. Not unpleasant, but it passed at once. The little guy closed his eyes and swayed as if his knees might fold him to the ground in his bear suit. After perhaps 10 seconds, he looked at me again, and tears spilled down his cheeks. Startled, I took my hand off his forehead. He said,
"I wish I could help you, mister. I really do. I truly wish it. But you're far beyond me. Way far beyond me. You're the true deal. The truest. Whatever it is you've got to do, only you can do it."
Then he did the strangest thing, but made it seem as natural as the words, "Hey, dude," with which he'd first greeted me. He took my hand in his 2 bear suit paws and kissed it. When he let go and raised his head, the tears on his cheeks glistened, and those yet unshed sparkled like galaxies in his large dark eyes. I didn't know what to say, and he had evidently said all that he would. With the bear head still under his right arm, he turned away from me. Seemingly stunned by his companion's words and deeds, Ollie encircled me with his massive arms, hugged me to him, let me go, and said,
"You take care of yourself, Norman."
Shuffling away, Lou said,
"His name isn't Norman."
Ollie returned to his companion's side and put a hand on his shoulder to halt him. Glancing at me, the strong man said,
"What is his name?"
"Truth," Lou said.
"That's a funny name."
"Mercy," Lou said.
"Truth Mercy? That's his name?"
"There's no right name for him."
"What did you see when he touched you?"
The little guy looked at me one last time and shook his head.
"Too much. I saw too much."
Evidently the illustrated man knew his friend well enough to realize that those were his final words on the subject. They walked away from me and did not glance back again. Shaken, I hurried out of the campground, up the long incline through knee-high grass and across the service road to the shorter slope. When I reached the top, returning to the midway behind the sideshow tents, I looked down at the trailers and motorhomes arrayed far below, just in time to see 2 police cruisers and a morgue van enter the campground with emergency lights flashing, but without sirens. Standing there, rerunning in memory the encounter with Lou and Ollie, I thought that if there were others in the world with wild talents similar to mine, they would surely find it as difficult to live like ordinary people as I did. Perhaps for some of them, merely simplifying their lives, living in one-room apartments, wearing only jeans and t-shirts, or another minimalist wardrobe, resolving not to complicate things by planning for the future, working in undemanding jobs such as fry cookery or tire sales, was not enough to keep them sane and give them hope. Maybe some of them needed to withdraw from society more than I did. Burdened with one kind of psychic perception or another, or several, some might find stability and a degree of peace in the carnival, where outcasts and nonviolent misfits had long been welcome, where odd ducks were accepted, and where no one sought to know the secrets of others in the show. Whatever Lou had seen when I touched him, his gift, or curse, obviously must be different from mine. He probably could not see the lingering spirits of the dead, but he might now know that I could. I suspected that he'd learned other things about me, too, perhaps including the nature of the suffering that I might have to endure in the hours ahead. Dwarf in a bear suit, comic figure in whatever show he performed, the little guy had no doubt known his share of bullies and tormentors. And yet it was a good bet that he had more foresight and more wisdom than the 33 mechanical oracles housed in All Things Foretold. I passed between 2 sideshow tents, back to the bright, loud, busy midway, no longer using psychic magnetism to seek out Wolfgang, Jonathan, and Celine, but focusing instead on the executioners, Jim and Bob. 23. Through the open bedroom window of the seaside cottage, came the pleasantly cool breath of the sea, but I sweated in twisted sheets. Perspiration streamed from me also in my turbulent nightmare, as the happy monster, Blossom Rosedale, led me toward what would prove to be the amaranth. No sounds existed now except those that I made, as if the outer world had ceased to exist, as though I had become the world entire, isolated and adrift in a void. The furious knocking of my heart, the gasping for breath, each inhalation inadequate to my need, and a hard chattering sound, something rattling that I could not identify. There were light and shadow, but no longer faces or mysterious shapes, only currents of color washing across my eyes, color and at times a rippling darkness, and I was very afraid. Sometimes Blossom seemed to manifest beside me like a spirit, but at other times I was not aware of her. Moving, moving forward, moving with great effort, moving but to what, to where? As the physicists tell us, time was created in the Big Bang, a necessary condition for the expansion and maturation of the universe. All that exists outside the universe exists also outside of time, where no experience is measured in minutes. In dreams, time exists, though not as we know it in the waking world, strangely distorted and unreliable, as if on a subconscious level we're aware that time isn't enduring, that it is not a required condition of our existence, that there comes a point when we will have no need of it. With or without Blossom, I seem to travel for hours, crossing a considerable distance, though it might also have been mere seconds before again I heard a sound not made by me. A voice cried out, and again a face appeared on which I could concentrate. The face was Wyatt Porter's, and the voice was his too, and he shouted my name, Adi. Blossom was with me again, supporting me. I struggled forward, gripping the urn of ashes with both hands, when the chief called my name again. My vision cleared further, and I stared down the muzzle of his pistol, which swelled in dimension until it was the diameter of a cannon barrel. He fired. 24. When seeking Wolfgang, I'd had no face to associate with the name, but I'd had his singular, gravelly voice to conjure in memory, which helped me focus my mind, my gift, and home in on him. In the case of Jim and Bob, I had glimpsed them from the back of the motorhome, but I hadn't seen their faces, and neither of them possessed a memorable voice. Having their first names only, I wasn't hopeful of being the Tonto that they feared. I still believed that the key to unlocking the cultists' plan and the means to thwart it could be found in the carnival, but the longer I stalked the midway, the more discouraged I became about my prospects of finding my quarry. I tried to navigate the surging crowd in the concourse, but the people repeatedly turned like a tide and resisted me, their faces either glassy with excitement or weary with a surfeit of joyless fun, but always indifferent to me, as the sea would be indifferent as it drowned me in a treacherous current. Each time I passed the carousel, the wild-eyed horses pumped up and down more frantically with each rotation, and the calliope seemed to pipe with greater frenzy, growing ever more off-key. The Dodgem cars crashed into one another with great and then greater abandon, their trolley poles striking ever-brighter showers of sparks from the overhead electric wire grid. The shrieking of the shrouded riders in the caterpillar and the screaming of those who stood in cages on the rapidly spinning and then up-tilting roulette wheel sounded not like expressions of delight, but instead like death cries of terrified people pierced by the pain of mortal wounds. As they stumbled and tumbled through the giant revolving barrel that expelled them from the funhouse, their shrill laughter was, to my ear, like the insane cackling in the deepest cells of an asylum. And all the while, the giant face of the ogre growled and blew out a fierce breath that took strollers by surprise. If I concentrated too intently on Jim and Bob, if I sought them too insistently, too urgently, through the strobing lights and flung shadows of the spinning rides, I risked becoming the hunted instead of the hunter in a moment of reverse psychic magnetism. Sometimes, when I tried too long or too ardently to be drawn to my quarry, they were instead drawn to me. On those occasions, I saw them only after I had been seen and recognized, which was a dangerous situation when those I sought were ruthless murderers. At last, the mélange of odors, frying burgers, diesel fumes from a generator, the reek of steam rising from grab-joint wells in which too many hot dogs had been boiled in the same water, cigarette smoke, cloying perfumes, human sweat, the stink of ripe manure wafting over from the animal exhibits in the part of the fair that was off the midway, and the whistling, honking, clattering, banging, hissing, ringing hoopla of the 10,000-voice Sombra Brothers extravaganza became too much for me to endure. When my senses were dialed wide open, as they had to be when I practiced psychic magnetism, I decided to take a brief break from the midway. I intended to return after a calming visit to the exhibition hall, where many county artists and craftsmen and homemakers exhibited their wares and participated in judged competitions for the coveted Best of the Year Blue Ribbon in categories ranging from quilts and needlepoint pillows to kiln-fired pottery, from homemade cookies and chili to elegant bentwood rocking chairs. When I passed the exhibition hall and kept going toward the main parking lot, where I'd left the dinged and dirty Ford Explorer, I realized that by shifting off the midway, I had shifted into gear. I was on the trail of Jim and Bob after all. Approaching the Explorer, I grew cautious. I half expected the two executioners to rise from the bed of a pickup truck in which they had been reclining in anticipation of me, or to step from behind one SUV or another. The parking lot was more brightly lighted than the Carney's campground. Before boarding the Explorer, I circled it, peering through the dust-filmed windows into the back seat in the cargo area to be certain that when I climbed into the driver's seat, I wouldn't be surprised by an unwanted passenger with a penchant for shooting people in the back of the head, though I was likewise averse to having my throat slit. By the time I piloted the Ford along the exit lane, I felt sure Jim and Bob had departed the fairgrounds. Even with as little as I knew about them, I seemed to be raveling toward them, spooling up an invisible ribbon that they had unspooled in their wake. I accelerated onto Maricopa Lane, which led first through the outskirts of town and then toward the center of it. Soon, I began to make a series of turns from street to street, turns that seemed to be meaningful, until I began to feel that I'd lost my quarry. In a residential neighborhood, I pulled to the curb, switched off the engine, and got out of the Explorer. I'd parked under a grandly spreading Ficus nitida, which most everyone called an Indian laurel, though it wasn't a laurel and had no connection to any Indian tribe. I stood with my back to the tree into the SUV, watching the nearby houses. A stillness lay upon the street. The torpid air stirred not a rustle from the dense foliage of the ficus. The front porches were deserted, and no one appeared on the sidewalk with or without a dog. Although lights glowed in a number of windows, I heard no muffled TVs, or even the faintest strains of music. Perhaps because the dense clouds had erased the moon and stars, because they lowered in what appeared to be preparation for an unseasonable storm, the town felt as though a pressure weighed upon it. I might not have been surprised if this reality and my dream had suddenly become one, if dead bodies floated into the street, drifting through the thick air as though through water, their eyes protuberant and their faces contorted in terror. Intending to call Chief Porter, I switched on my phone. But then, at the end of the block, a car rounded the corner that I'd recently turned, and it started toward me, and the fine hairs prickled along the back of my neck. I wasn't near a street lamp. Cloaked in shadows, pressed against the ancient ficus, I doubted that they could have seen me yet. I slid down until I was sitting on the sidewalk, the massive trunk of the tree and then the explorer between me and them. They probably weren't assassins. More likely, they were a couple of harmless elderly citizens coming home from a church supper, talking about hemorrhoid creams or whatever elderly couples talked about. The vehicle approached slowly, or so it seemed to me, and for sure it slowed somewhat as it passed the explorer. But then it picked up speed and continued on its way. I dared to look after it and saw a white Mercedes SUV. No one leaned out of the window to empty a .357 Magnum in my direction. I had not seen a face or even a form in the car, as if it had been driven by something other than the living or the dead, both of whom I can see. My eventful life is conducive to paranoia, but I'm generally able to avoid imagining that there's a boogeyman under my bed. This cult was tying knots in my nerves. The memory of that collection of severed heads in glass jars back in Nevada did kind of linger. I got to my feet, leaned against the tree as before, and phoned Chief Porter. He answered on the second ring, and I said, "You're in the motorhome, sir?"
"The CSI team has it for a little while yet. We'll search it as soon as they're done, when we don't have to worry about contaminating the scene."
"Meanwhile, you're talking to other carnies in the campground?"
"They're not the most talkative folks."
"Ask them if they know a Jim and a Bob."
"Jim what? Bob who?"
"That's all I know. They're the executioners."
"Well, everyone knows a bunch of Jims and Bobs. Must be a million Jims and Bobs in California alone."
"This Jim and Bob hang out together."
"Well, that narrows it down to 990,000. Are they carnies?"
"I don't know. But there's somebody in the campground you might get something from. He's kind of like me, but you should pretend not to know that."
"He's what, a fry cook?"
"No, sir. I ran into him after I called you about the murders and left the motorhome. He's a carny. He's got a sixth sense of some kind, for real. I'm not sure about the scope of it."
"What's his name?"
"Oh, sorry. His name's Lou, and he has a friend there named Ollie."
"Lou what? Ollie who?"
"I didn't get their last names, sir. But they'll be easy to find. Lou is a dwarf in a bear suit. Ollie's a huge guy, tattooed head to foot."
"In a bear suit?"
"Not Ollie, no, just Lou. And he's probably taken it off by now. Lou might open up to you more if you tell him you know me, and you know about my gift. By the way, he knows me as Norman." Two houses to my right, a man came out of the front door and stood on the dark porch. I was so tense it seemed to me that a guy standing on a porch was the most suspicious thing I'd ever seen. The chief said,
"Well, Norman, I've never told anyone about your gift except Carla."
I couldn't be sure if the man on the porch saw me. I lowered my voice. "I appreciate you keeping my secret, Chief. I really do. But if we don't find these guys and stop them, things are going to get very desperate very fast."
"Why are you whispering?"
"Some guy came out on a porch."
"Is it Jim or Bob?"
"No, sir. It's just some guy, I think." A lighter flared. Porch guy had stepped outside to smoke a cigarette, or so it appeared. Chief Porter said,
"Where are you, son?"
"Standing under a ficus nitida, waiting for inspiration."
"What's a ficus nitida?"
I looked up into the web of dark branches. "You probably called it an Indian laurel. Did you send someone out to the dam?"
"Sonny Wexler and Billy Monday should be there by now."
"You're two best. I'm glad you're taking this seriously, sir."
"I always take you seriously, son. Even when there's a dwarf in a bear suit."
"He's a nice little person, by the way. He doesn't have an edge like that guy in the reality TV show."
"There's another thing happened," Chief Porter said, "just a few minutes ago. An alert came over the wire from Homeland Security. Three armed guards were transporting a truckload of C-4 between the manufacturer and the weapons depot at an army base."
"Plastic explosives."
"That's right. One of the guards killed the other two and hijacked the shipment."
"How much C-4?
"Might have been 1,000 kilos.
I shivered in the warm night.
Enough to blow up the dam.
Twice over, the chief said.
When did this happen?
About 3 hours ago, but we just got word on the wire.
Where did it happen?
They think about 30 miles from here. The feds say not to worry, they're all over it. They just found the truck. The C-4 had been offloaded into another vehicle.
What vehicle?
That seems to be anyone's guess. When the feds say they're all over it, it doesn't mean they're all over it.
I'd better get my mojo working, I said.
I sure hope you can, son. We need you on this. So, why did you call it a ficus didida?
Nitida. That's the correct botanical name, sir. Ozzie Boone insists that even if a writer uses the common name of a tree or other plant, he ought to know the correct botanical name. He says that no matter what you're writing about, you need to know a whole lot more on the subject than what you put on the page, or otherwise the work won't have any depth.
So you're still writing your memoirs?
Yes, sir, as I get the chance.
I guess you know a lot about Indian laurels, then.
I could go on for hours.
I just realized I don't have your phone number.
I gave it to him.
Things are moving fast, he said. I'll be back to you soon.
I terminated the call.
A faint trace of cigarette smoke scented the still air. In the darkness of the porch, the smoker took a deep drag, and the end of his cigarette glowed hot orange. Watching the man, I thought of a fuse on a stick of dynamite. Plastic explosives were detonated with an electric current, not with a fuse, not with a flame. But I thought of a fuse anyway. 25. Driving around, odd as I've always been, thinking, Jim, Bob,